I am Bob, and I am an alcoholic. And an abuser of several other substances. I'm really glad to be here. This is great. I didn't know I was speaking at young people's meeting until I got here. And it lifted my spirits. I was hot. The drive sucked. There were insane people on the road. You know, I mean, I'd like to be some spiritual monster of a speaker, but basically by the time I hit here, I wasn't just excited. And it's like they said, you know, you're speaking at young people's meeting. I said, wow, that's great. I love that. I'm 62 years old. What am I doing here? Of course, I've been sober 36 years, too. Perhaps that has something to do with it. And I was 26 when I got sober, and I probably haven't grown up that much. And it's not from lack of trying, because the basic societal image of growing up makes me want to vomit. So I just kind of have to find my own path in recovery. In the process of finding my own path in recovery, I've managed to just about alienate, 50% of the program. And I think they care. I wish they knew that I didn't, but it's okay. And it's interesting, I find that when you speak your truth from the podium, that so many people can get upset. I mean, I understand why, but it still fascinates me. And particularly people with long recovery. And it's like, I grew up in a home with a child batterer for a mother and an alcoholic for a father. So I never, ever was able to get a hold of the concept that you and I can have a different opinion and neither one of us has to be wrong. See, you either held whatever opinion the largest adult home at the moment held, or you were wrong. So I learned to think either or my whole life. I never knew that there was a middle ground. And it didn't appeal to me. You know, the people that lived in it looked dull and boring. And I needed excitement. That was like my drug until I found alcohol and drugs was anxiety. And that became my drug of choice in recovery, anxiety. I don't know what you do for fun, but anxiety works very well for me. One reason it works well is I don't need anyone. You know, I don't need anybody to create anxiety. I can just sit down at home alone in a chair and make myself completely insane. Add a phone call or a little mail. The mail, by the way, which I don't open, and I still get nuts, you know. This is kind of an interesting time for me to come back here. I spoke here about 25 years ago, I think it was, and my wife had just died at that time in recovery. Same circumstances, cancer, drugs all over the house. Almost everything she got was IV. I think she was blessed. God blessed her that I was there because, you know, when we didn't have nurses, I had a little history with how you do that. And it was, it's an experience. My childhood sucked. I don't know about anybody else's, but mine was horrible. And I get really sick and tired of hearing it. Hey, your parents did the very best job they could. That's a popular statement in AA, and I understand why, because AA is filled with alcoholic parents who were practicing with children. And so, you know, if I don't want to work on that stuff, I don't want to hear anything other than I did the best I could. Well, the truth about that is, it's a true statement. It is true. My mother was a world-class child beater. My mother broke my nose, tore out the corners of my eyes, knocked out my teeth. I'm a seriously battered child. I missed so much school my first year at 5 years of age, they wouldn't even give me a grade because she couldn't let me go because I looked too bad. Had my mother done to me in 1998 what she did to me from 1935 to 1946, she'd be in prison today. You see, but then you didn't interfere with what your neighbors did to their kids. It was none of your business. If they beat the hell out of them, it was just too bad, you know. And so that was basically how I was brought up. So did my mom do the best she could? Sure she did. Sure she did. I have no argument with that. What I have the argument with is the incomplete statement. And the incomplete statement is that my parents did the best job they could, period. My parents did the best job they could, comma, but the job they did is criminally punishable in the court of law. And the job they did is not okay. And it wasn't nurturing or healthy or helpful or anything. It sucked, basically. So I don't have to absolve them. You know, it's like Father Leo says all the time, there's some things that only God can forgive. You know? And I basically accept that. There's just some things it's up to God to forgive. I can't get there, and I hate intellectual forgiveness. I hate that concept that somehow I can think my way into forgiving past wrongs that were very hurtful to me. It doesn't work for me. I used to try that so hard with my mother. I'd just think, you know, I'd be going to go down and see them, my mom and my stepdad, and I'd think about she did the best job she could, and man, I just worked myself into a frenzy to forgive her, and I know I forgive her, and I drive down to Fallbrook, she opens the door, and I want a flamethrower, you know? So the forgiveness was intellectual, but it didn't get to me emotionally. And what I eventually discovered for me was forgiveness has got to come as part of the process of recovery. I can't force it. I can't make it happen because I'm 18 months recovered and by now I should have forgiven my mother. You know? It took me decades to forgive my mother. And it didn't come in some big intellectual awareness and it didn't come in some big spiritual flash. It came in a very quiet moment. I don't even know what I was doing. And the thought crossed through me, I wonder what my grandparents did to my mother to so set her up, to so destroy her only child. And I got it that was my first act of true forgiveness towards my mom. And then I could see her as a little child standing out in front of her house with a little dress on, with hopes and dreams, like all of us have. And somehow they took those away from her. Don't know how, don't have any idea how, but they took them away from her. And then she married a man who was empty and drunk and unsatisfying. And so being the other male in the house, I got the punishment, you know, that she couldn't hand out to him. Well, needless to say, that set me up for just a whole hell of a lot of fun in school. I didn't have much respect for teachers, but I had a horrible fear of them. And the other thing I didn't want to do is I didn't want to look stupid. And I had a severe attention deficit disorder, and of course they didn't know anything about that then. And so I was really slow getting stuff, you know. It just took me forever to put it together in my brain. And there was two reasons for that. One was the ADD, certainly. And the other was being hammered all the time at home. I remember Mrs. Cooney in the second grade at 52nd Street Elementary School. Now, my God, I was 7 years old in the second grade. So that's a little while ago to remember Mrs. Cooney. And I remember one day she was a big, large woman with corrective shoes who didn't like children, basically, with Mrs. Cooney. And I remember going up to the blackboard and putting up a two, a plus sign, drawing a line and spinning on me and saying, Bobby. And I'm sitting there thinking, God, you know, I got stuff to work out before I answer this question for her. The first thing I need to know is why she wants to know. All right? Because I judge the world based on my home life. And they're asking me stuff they don't need to know. So I got to figure out, does she have a right to know? Once I've worked out, you know, that it's part of her job description to require some kind of confirmation that I am in fact retaining the information she's dispensing, now I got to figure out, does she know the answer herself? Because at home I'm getting asked questions by people who don't know the answer, and I'm giving them the answer, and I'm on my ass in a second, you know? So I got all this to work out before I answer this question. And plus, I got to keep focusing on that blackboard. And I can only really focus under tension. If I can get tense enough, I can focus. If I get a little relaxed, I'm gone. You know, leaving my body has been a lifetime experience ever since I can remember. I do not remember ever being comfortable in my body as a kid. I just wasn't comfortable in it. It wasn't okay. I just somehow knew there was something wrong with it. And I couldn't tell you what. Had no idea what, but I was very definitely uncomfortable. Well, while I'm trying, struggling to work out this little 2+2 problem, sitting next to me is Susie, who I still remember all this many years later. Susie was an overachiever. Susie was the one that was going to get straight A's until she died. My guess would be if I came across Susie today, she'd have more credentials than she was able to use in her life and had graduated with straight A's from everything, if she hasn't blown her brains out in the process. Her father was also an alcoholic, a real visual kind. My dad wasn't a visual alcoholic. Her dad was the kind that left the Christmas lights on the house till July. Which by that point, it's too late to take them off because, you know, Christmas is just around the corner. So Susie, because of the way the society was set up then and still now, basically, if a child brings home straight A's, there's a lot of people who accept that as an indication that the family's okay. And nothing could be farther from the truth. Yeah, I've done a lot of research on all this stuff about families and children and alcoholism and addiction and all the rest of that. And I found more screwed up families behind the student with straight A's than the guy who's getting D's. They look good on the surface. I have grown up in a society that says you gotta look good on the surface. Everything out there that I get hammered with daily says I don't use the right deodorant, I don't use the right toothpaste, I don't weigh the right amount, and unfortunately right now I don't because I'm sort of a periodic with exercise. I never was a periodic when I was drinking. Never. I mean, there was never a week in my life unless I was incarcerated in the hole where I could not get high. And yet with exercise, I'm a hopeless periodic. And I'll get in there and just wail for months, you know, until I get down to comfortable weight, looking good, feeling good, oxygen in my lungs again, just, you know, and then I don't know what happens. You know, this is what happens, actually. I'm back at it now. I'm glad to report. I wish they'd invented a machine. You know, everybody keeps saying, well, I'll have a pill, you know, so we can drink, which I have no interest in because if it doesn't do anything for me, I don't really care about it. So it's like, I just can't imagine that, but I would like to have a machine, like a chair or something you just sit in. 10-15 minutes TV, you know, channel surfing, and you get up looking. Told you I haven't grown up. Anyway, poor Susie, she could no longer stand the silence, and she jumped up and put these four fingers up in the air and said, four! I thought, oh, God, now I know what's coming. You know, I'm going to the principal's office with a note. Susie's going to go home and get a lot of praise, and at recess I got to figure out how to kill her, you know. Because what Susie did was the one thing I never wanted anybody to do in my life. Susie drew public attention to the fact that I'm not okay. And I felt inadequate. I mean, this is the way I felt ever since I can remember. Inadequate, incomplete, insufficient, and I always felt like I had this little tiny pot of sewage inside of me, kind of bubbling, blah, 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 you know. And my job in life was to make sure that none of you ever, ever saw that little bubbling pot of sewage. It's that simple. Now the sewage has a name. It's called shame. I didn't know that then. I was ashamed of who I believed myself to be. Man, now there's a cross to bear. I was ashamed of who I believed myself to be. And like I said, there's so much advertisement and everything that supports that you're not okay. You know? Why the hell do you think they put numbers and letters on the back of automobiles? I mean, there's no need to put numbers and letters on the backs of automobiles. It's a car. It's transportation. Originally, once upon a time. But now, it's who we are. Right? You know, I can be blown down the highway in my 650 CSI Beamer, you know, and just, you know, I can blow by somebody with their little 530 Beamer and I'll speed past, I don't have a Beamer by the way, slide over, slow down so they can read the numbers on my back so we each know who's the superior person in this exchanger. This is all over goddamn cars, right? And I speed on down the highway and I'm all right, you know. And then, of course, somebody comes smoking past me in a black 766 CS XXX with gold wheels like I'm tied to a pole. He also slows down so I can read his numbers. And he's gone. We do it at stoplights. I have a friend who can afford any car he wants. And when he buys one, he takes all the numbers and letters and everything off the back of it. And people get infuriated when he won't tell them what it is. Usually it's a big Mercedes coupe, but he won't tell them what it is. So they have no idea what it is. And they get angry that he won't tell them because they don't know where they are in relation to him. You know? So if I already felt inadequate and incomplete and insufficient, I'm growing up in this world that says you aren't enough. They're always the bigger car, you know? There's always a bigger house. There's always more money. There's always a thinner body. There's always something. And I just became riddled with madness inside, comparing my inside to how you looked outside. And I never matched up. And if you looked okay, I took what you said as gospel. They may have just, you know, they'd be standing there in a nice suit and a tie, looking good, you know, conservative, and say something, and I'd figure, oh, that's okay, that's right. The guy could have just gone out of the nut house for all I know. I don't know. But he looks okay. And to me, that was what it was about. Anyway, school sucked. I got bigger. I hit 6 feet at 12, and that was the end of my having to put up with my instructors. I didn't like class. I'd walk by the desk, throw my books in the wastebasket, and make some socially unacceptable gesture and walk out of the room. The vice principal, of course, didn't want to see me again ever because I'd already put one or two chairs through his window, so it was like, leave him alone. And the thing that fascinates me is I was really a pretty sweet-looking kid, and you would think somebody would have wondered why I was so mad. Why was I so, so furious? Nobody bothered to ask. Well, I grew up in Los Angeles. When I was 15, I went to manual arts. I hadn't drank yet or used anything yet. And I don't know how long I lasted there. It wasn't long, less than a semester. And there used to be a high school in Los Angeles called Jacob Riis High School. Jacob Riis was for the bad boys. It was where they sent you when you couldn't make it in any of the other schools, trade school or otherwise. And I don't think there was ever a teaching credential among the adults at Jacob Riis. They were all either currently employed as juvenile police officers or retired juvenile police officers. Basically, their job was to keep us off the streets for about 7.5 hours before we were released on the public again. And the interesting thing that used to puzzle me then, and it still puzzles me now, is 2 blocks away was, I can't remember the name of the school, but it was an identical school for girls. And they were always wondering why they were having so much trouble in the streets. So you put all the bad boys from high school here and all the bad girls here, and there's 2 blocks in between. What the hell do you think is going to happen? You know? I think sometimes our government just... I remember sitting in Tucson with Tina, and we were watching television, and on came this government anti-drug ad. Okay? There's this EEG on the screen. And this authoritative voice is saying, this is the brain energy of a 14-year-old, normal 14-year-old child. And the needle is just screaming along like that. Then comes on a new sheet, and the voice says, this is the brain activity of a 14-year-old child who has smoked a marijuana cigarette. It's kind of going like this. Yeah, right? My ex can verify this for you. I fell onto the floor off the couch in hysteria. I said, do they not realize? Do any of the idiots that put this together not realize that there's 20 million 14-year-olds right now looking at that screen saying, that looks pretty good to me, man. Yeah? I'm so sick of this, I could scream, you know. Oh, all that crap. It's just, oh, God. Just Say No was one of my very favorites. Yeah, sure, it changes your entire life, how you feel, you know, and Just Say No. Anyway, to give you a sense of my mental state of mind, at 15 years of age, not having drank and not having used any drugs of any kind, I lasted one day in Jacob Riis High School. At the end of one day in Jacob Riis High School, they came to my mother and said, that's it. We do not want your son in the Los Angeles City school system. One day. That's how crazy I was. That's how completely just out of control I was. I couldn't be dealt with. 3 days later, I went to the beach with some friends of mine, and we hooked up with some friends of theirs. Their friends had some marijuana cigarettes and a half-gallon jug of red wine. I smoked a marijuana cigarette and drank about a third of that gallon of red wine, half gallon of red wine. And I shouldn't have to tell anybody in this room what happened. If I have to tell you, you're in the wrong room or you're Al-Anon. It changed my life. For the first time, I was comfortable in my body. I didn't feel inadequate or inferior or insecure. The little pot of sewage was gone. It was all right. Everything was all right. And I had 3 great years. I used to be really neurotic about germs. I don't know why. I don't know where it came from. Maybe it was my dad. Maybe it was my mother. I couldn't tell you, but I was like nuts about germs. So I can remember when I moved on to some heavier narcotics and heavier booze like Jim Beam and Jack Daniels and stuff like that. Somebody gave me some heroin, Mexican heroin, brown. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, man. How was this put together, you know? I mean, as far as I know, some dog could have peed on this stuff, you know? I mean, I don't know, you know? It's like, what's in here? You know, this is just, you know, not workable for me, you know? I mean, I tried it and said, I could feel little things crawling through my body, bacteria and germs, and I knew I was going to die in about 7 minutes, you know, from some virus from the heroin. So I had a couple of small shotguns, and I started to take off pharmaceutical warehouses because morphine comes in a case of 144 bottles. It's dated, so you know it's fresh. It's been sterilely manufactured, and you don't have to worry about it. You know, you're okay. The first panel my sponsors ever gave me in AA was County Hospital in downtown Los Angeles, and I had not yet. I was 6 months sober. Once you were 6 months, you could go. I hadn't gotten over my neurosis about germs yet. I was only 6 months sober. I hadn't gotten over anything. I was still completely insane. And so I go to the county hospital. I have no idea what we're going to do. We all meet in this little room. They give me a book. And in the book is the list of all the patients in the hospital and then why they're there. And if their doctors were cool, because they'd help us out, if they put a little star by somebody if they broke their leg but they'd been drinking. Otherwise, you'd never pick them up. It'd just say broken leg, and the doctors would put a star. So we knew who all to go talk to. So I take my little book and my, you know, pile of literature and head off down the hall and walk in the first room, and here's Joe in the first room. Joe has been drinking wine and living outdoors for 40 years, okay? He's got open sores all over his body. Joe is laying there in bed doing what most of us do with things that itch. He's scratching them, you know? I stand far enough away from the bed my clothes won't touch the bed because I don't want to get this crap on my clothes. And I say, hi, I'm Bob. I'm from AA. Joe looks up. He wants to shake hands. This is beyond me. And the only thing I can think of is my sponsor's voice ringing in my ears saying, on any given occasion, you may be the only example of AA a man will ever see. Be the best one you can. So I shake hands with Joe. And I stand there and talk to him about AA, hold my arm out like this, you know. It won't touch my clothes or anything, you know. I'm down the hall to the bathroom, right past the soap for the general public into the surgical soap, you know, to wash my hands. I had that panel for a year. I probably washed my hands 30 times a night. But I had to go. You know, that's one thing I was so grateful for. Man, my sponsors didn't know anything about weak care. Gentleness was a word they never heard. Obi Cully had been a boss con at Folsom Penitentiary. He was a frightening human being. And he was the first one I ever met I was afraid of. That was part of why they used to lock me up. And as I couldn't find, I was so afraid of being afraid, I wasn't afraid. And I just did what they told me because they were going to physically hurt me if I didn't. You know, it wasn't about, son, you will have blessed spiritual recovery. if you go to this hospital and help your suffering brother alcoholic. Just go to the hospital, we break your back. You know? So I go to the hospital. I remember getting in the car when I'd come out. I'd look at my steering wheel and think, oh, God. I'm going to have to touch it in the morning when I'm clean. And I'd put a rag over it and drive home. That stuff kept me sober. You know, I need to be that intense, you know, focused. Anyway, I had 3 good years and 8 bad years, basically. That sums up my drinking and using. Lost 2 shootouts with the Los Angeles Police Department, a few other minor inconveniences in my life. But other than that, you know, I'm okay. A few stab wounds, 2 bullet holes, you know, but when you're a psychopath, you don't really notice it anyway. It's like... I remember one guy cut me from here to here, and they got the stitches in me, and I left, went back to the party where he was, dropped him like a rock, and ripped all the stitches out of my arm in the process of doing it. So I have a scar now about 3 times as big as it needed to be if I hadn't been just off the map. But I didn't know how to deal with feelings. I didn't know what they were. They weren't expressed in my home. The only thing expressed in my home was rage or silence. Remember I said, all I know is either or. That's all I know. I don't know about the middle. I don't know that 2 people can hold differing opinions and be right. I don't understand any of that, or at least I didn't used to understand any of that. Now I'd like to give a commercial for God. If there was not for me an all-powerful, ever-present, loving God, we wouldn't be having this conversation tonight. I never could have gotten here without God, much less stayed here. I talk about a lot of this high-rolling stuff, but in reality, my last arrest was common drunk, place of arrest, main floor, city jail. Now, that's a piece of work, I want you to know. Let me see if any of you can identify with my thinking. I've gotten a DUI, and I got it. I wasn't blacked out. I knew what I was doing. This is the frightening part. I've retained this part of my drinking so I can remember how really completely off the map my mind can go. I'd come out of this bar in downtown Los Angeles. I'd gotten on the San Bernardino freeway at Los Angeles Street, and just as I got up on the freeway and started going, I remembered this blonde at the bar that I hadn't taken a run at. I thought, I can't go home without talking to her, you know? Because I'll just keep myself awake, you know, for 3 days over what could have been, but it wasn't because I didn't, you know? I spent a lot of energy on that little subject. So I'm thinking, God, I got to get off on Macy. I got to go over the bridge, you know, and by County Hospital, back under the freeway. Oh, Jesus, too much. You know, it's much simpler just to turn around and go back. Is that not logical or something? It is. Let's just turn around, you know. Go slowly in the right-hand lane. What the hell can happen? I can tell you what can happen. You can run head-on into a Los Angeles police car. We were both fortunately going slow. No one was injured, but they were not happy. With me, they had no apparent sense of humor at the time. So this judge, disregarding my entire jacket, gives me 10 days in Lincoln Heights County Jail, or Lincoln Heights City Jail, to be served on 5 weekends. I'm living in Pasadena. I gotta say, I don't have a car anymore. I can't afford one, and I've, you know, wrecked enough of them. I sold my last car knowing that I was gonna kill somebody. You know, don't tell me that's not God working. I just sold it. Didn't even have one when I got rid of it. I just thought, I can't drive anymore, man. I mean, I'm coming home. There's dents. I don't know where they came from. I can't remember anything. Just get rid of the car. So I got rid of the car, rode the bus to downtown Los Angeles, and right there along the sidewalk by the bus station, there used to be this big, wonderful bar. And I looked at the bar, and I thought, I'm going to jail. Right? Now, to go to jail sober made no sense to me. I couldn't even grasp that concept. It would have been like you know, standing in front of a moving train as far as I was concerned. So I got drunk and I showed up and I was 3 hours late and just out of my gourd. And they screamed and yelled at me and threatened me. They said, you will go back immediately before the judge that sentenced you. Yadda, 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 with your jacket. This is failure to execute a sentence. It's a felony. Blah, 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 blah. You're gone for 10 years. I heard all that. Got off the bus the next weekend on Friday. Looked at the bar and thought, right? I couldn't go to jail sober. It just made no sense to walk into a jail sober. Who on God's earth would do that? So I was drunk again, and this time they just arrested me for drunk, put me in the drunk tank. Now I've missed my weekend, right? Because I was never able to get upstairs to sign in. So as far as the court is concerned, I didn't show up. They send me back before the judge who has originally sentenced me. I'm standing there, sitting there. I'm looking for a Christian somewhere. Anybody with a program, you know? I mean, there are guys out there who understand this. You get in court, you start looking for the person with a book, or some, you know, big book, because they got something going on and you want to volunteer. Because if you don't, you're going to be gone for so long, man. It's not even worth thinking about. So I'm looking for a book, a Christian, a Bible, anything that morning so I can volunteer. Nobody. All right? I sit down and there's a guy in front of me, goes before me. I thought, cool, I get a chance to get a little sense of the judge's mood and know what's going to happen to me. He gives this kid 10 days to be served on 5 weekends, Lincoln Heights Jail, for driving under the influence. The kid says to him, hey, man, you know, I just soon do the 10 days straight, if you don't mind. The judge said, no, not at all. I was just trying to have a little consideration for your wife and child and your employer. That's cool with me. He said, you can do another 180 on top of that 10. So maybe you can learn to have a little respect for your wife and your child and your employer. I thought, well, I'm not going to have to worry about meals for a long time here, you know. I'm going to be eating on the state again. So I get up in front of him, I say, Your Honor, I'd like to say something. You know, I don't know why it is, as a practicing alcoholic, I always found it necessary to tell people stuff they already knew. You know? It just seemed like I spent half my days doing it. He says, well, go ahead. I said, well, I have a drinking problem. He didn't know this, you know? I said to him, I'm going to go to AA. I'm going to do something about this drinking. I don't know, you know, I gotta just do something. I didn't know where I heard AA. They must have had meetings in Lincoln Heights Jail or something. That's the only thing I can think of. I'd never heard of it, never been there, didn't know anybody that went, and had no desire to go. And his whole demeanor changed the minute I said that. And he smiled. And he said, good. I'm happy for you. He said, you're going to make a lot of friends. He said, you're going to be able to find a new way of life. And he pounded on my jacket, which was about like this. And he said, you know, and for the first time in your life, you can become a useful member of this society. I thought, wow, that's cool, right? And he let me go. They would review my sentencing in a year or something. I go back to Pasadena, where I'm living in doorways now. I have no money. I was living outdoors, and it wasn't even fashionable. So I got an ad from the paper, Alcoholics Anonymous, a nickel or dime, whatever the hell phone call was in 1962. I go to the phone time after time after time after time after time out of my little doorway, and guess what? I can't call and ask for help. I can't ask anybody for help of any kind for anything. I didn't grow up where you asked for help. My neighborhood, man, you've been cut. You just say, excuse me, I'll be back. You know, I'm bleeding. I'll get a rag. So I can stop dripping blood on your carpet. I mean, that's it, you know. You just don't ask anybody for anything. So the concept of calling up somebody in an office somewhere that I don't know is beyond me. And I can't call. I'm living in doorways. I weigh 135 pounds. I weigh about 205 now, you know. So you take the difference off of me, 40 pounds, and you get a... You get a sense of what, no, about 70 pounds. And you get a sense of what I look like. I weighed in AA, 135. And no brains. Nothing but misfiring synapses. Wires gone bad. That's all there was left. And I couldn't make that phone call. I could not make that phone call. My sense of shame about who I was so great, I couldn't admit it to anybody that I couldn't fix it by myself. Okay? One day I'm sitting in my doorway and there's this shadow over me and this voice says, "Hey, you ain't got any place to stay. You can come stay with me and the old lady." And I look up, here's this guy, I've known him and his wife and his six kids. They've been on welfare ever since I've known him. And I laid a lot of money off of him from robberies and stuff, so he probably owed me about $5,000. This was $5,000, $1,962, when $5,000 represented something. You know what I mean? So I can go with him because he owes me. He owes me. It is his responsibility to take me out of that doorway and take me home. So I go. This is my God at work in my life. Eskimo number one was the judge. Eskimo number two was Chuck. He and his wife and six kids are living in this one-bedroom apartment about a block from where my doorway was in what used to be Pasadena's small but unique Skid Row. Don't ask me why I was in Pasadena. I have no idea. I'm 36 years sober, and I still can't figure it out. Other than the only thing I've been able to come up with is I had no respect for their police department, so that was probably why I was there. You know? Otherwise, I couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you why I was in Pasadena. This apartment's filled with cockroaches. Well, unfortunately, I also bring my own cockroaches with me. And you can't kill them because you don't want to be stomping on nothing that's there, you know? I mean, I don't know which ones are his and which ones are mine. So I'm at risk of looking really, like, gone over the edge. And having spent more than enough time on the sixth floor of County Psycho, I've just lay down on the floor and I got to let them walk on me at night because I don't know which ones are real and which ones aren't. And I'm laying there and I'm sick and I'm just gone. I said to him, you know, one of these days, man, I've got to call this AA thing and do something about my drinking. Now, here I am. You know, I've done a lot of horrible things. A lot of people have been hurt. I used to take off both ends of drug deals that I wasn't involved in any way. You can make a lot of people mad. I lived on red alert my whole life, you know. People were looking to kill me for very good reasons. And I cannot call to save my life. And I would have thought a God who would watch me do what I've done wouldn't love me. Couldn't love me. I can't love me. How can God love me? God's supposed to be inside of you. There's nothing good inside of me. So God can't be in there where there's nothing good. And right after I say, I got to, you know, one of these days, I mean, it's always one of these days, I call A and do something about my drink. He says, there's a girl down the hall, goes to AA. 1962. I had no idea what a woman would look like that went to AA. It was beyond me to even imagine. Gravel Gertie was about the best I could come up with. You know, I had no, curiosity is like one of the main forces of my being. I'm the guy that goes through the door at the airport that says, you know, don't, boys only. I'm always looking around corners and stuff, chasing police cars, you know, that go by with lights and siren on, see where they're going, what's going on, you know, becoming the last car in a police chase in the city of Los Angeles. This is recently. This is not, you know, a long time ago. I gotta know. What's going on, man? Excitement. Go walk down the hall, knock on the door. A girl opens this door, is big enough to break every bone in my body, man. She stood about 6'2", 6'3", weighed about 235, built like a professional football fullback, had short black hair, tattoos down both arms and both legs, and this is really long before it was fashionable, and a half full pint of booze. This is my introduction. This is the introduction God gave me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think we got to stop worrying about what we say to the newcomer. You know? Maybe we're forgetting where the newcomer is coming from. Because I looked at her and said, far out. You know? Street people, man. Somebody I can talk to. We got a bond here. So I looked at her and said, I'm curious about this AA thing. And she looked me dead in the eyes. He said, hey, we'll work if you want it, and I am not ready to quit drinking. Made perfect sense to me. You know, just like turning around on the freeway. I thought, you know, well, if I was as big and strong as you, I wouldn't quit either. You know, but I'm skinny, crazy, sick, with no place to go. She felt responsibility to AA for the sobriety she had had and took me to a meeting. 28th of August, 1962. Was I happy to be here? No. Not particularly. I was sober in Pasadena. I had nothing to talk about with the people there. There were men there who had done a better job with their lives drunk than I was doing currently sober. You know, one day they passed out at the country club on the 18th green, embarrassed themselves, and got sober. We didn't have a hell of a lot to say to each other. You know what I mean? I mean, their life, they had a life. I didn't even have a life. I had a doorway. There's a lot of sayings in AA that I don't know where they came from, that they've become gospel over the years. They amuse the hell out of me. They're not written anywhere. They're not in the book. They're just there. One of my favorites is, don't get emotionally involved the first year. Why not? Where the hell is that written? Nowhere. Who came up with that? Probably somebody incapable of having a relationship. You know? I can remember, I used to put my babies on celibacy when I was in a rotten mood. You know? I was feeling like crap, some woman gave me a bad time, they were going on celibacy. I cared. I am a big supporter of people getting emotionally involved the first year. I think, first of all, you'll spend more time with your sponsor. You know. Than you will otherwise. Otherwise, you'll call every couple, 3 days, you know, you'll meet her at a couple of meetings, and it'll be relaxed. If you're in a relationship, you'll be talking to your sponsor once or twice a day instead of once or twice a year. God, however, in his infinite wisdom, I was 3 weeks sober in Pasadena, and I couldn't find a sponsor because they'd keep saying, tell me a little bit about yourself, and I would, and they didn't want to sponsor me. So I didn't have a sponsor. I was 3 weeks sober, and they asked me to give a 10-minute talk. This is a true story. There's a lot of people around who know it. And Betty remembers it. There was a girl at that meeting, about 6, 7 years older than me, who had 3 months of sobriety. Her sponsor had told her, if you hear something you like, take it home. Now, any sane, rational human being would have known that if someone interpreted that phrase that way, there was something wrong with them. But she suggested it, and it seemed like a grand idea to me, you know? And we went home, and we had great sex for a couple of weeks, and she had a complete emotional breakdown and landed in a private psychiatric hospital. And I don't know what to do because I don't have a sponsor, and I feel responsible, you know? Because I always kind of thought, before it happened, I sort of thought that's always what sober sex would be, you know? You'd get together, you'd have wild, just wonderful, just intense sex for a couple of weeks, and then one of you will lose your mind. And the other one would go on, you know, with their life. So I just went every day to this private psychiatric hospital. I took get well cards, which I fully understand now is really obscene with a patient there for mental illness, but I didn't get it at the time, and I meant well, you know, I mean, I meant well. I took the big book, we read the big book, sat by the, you know, swimming pool in this private psychiatric unit, planned the rest of our lives together with God and AA. That would have terrified most of the people I knew sober then, you know, terrified them. Didn't terrify us. Made sense to us, worked for us. We're together about a year and a half. We're one of those couples that went apart and separated so much and went back together. Everyone we knew said to us, if you go back together one more time, we'll never talk to you again. Which is not what you want to say because, you know, it just means you got to do it one more time. I could not have not done it one more time. Then, as God would have it, I didn't see her for 10 years. 10 years. In Southern California. Both in AA, both in Southern California, our paths never crossed. Spoke all the time, our paths never crossed. 10 years later, I walk into Burbank Sunday morning meeting. She's over here in one corner at one end of the hall, which is, seems to me is almost as big as this, probably is about half the size of this. I was at the other corner. We saw each other. We took off across the Solano Club, man, like a Clairol ad. You know, just... We met about in the middle of the room, wrapped ourselves around each other, and simultaneously said the identical thing. We both said, thank you for being part of saving my life. Because now we had 10 years to look back. And we could be, we had more information now. We're able to use this information. You see, she trusted everybody, which is as dangerous here as trusting nobody is. Some guy convinced her to, speaking of Monica Lewinsky, at her first meeting, some guy convinced her that the problem with alcoholic women is that they're sexually repressed and that they need to loosen up, and he convinced her to blow him in the front seat of his car outside the meeting. That's somebody about 15 years sober. It's as dangerous to trust everybody as it is to trust nobody here. I mean, we did not come in here, many of us, certainly not me, with high moral fiber. You know, taking what was yours is all I knew. Woman, dope, car, money, you know. I didn't want to hear you tell me I love you. I immediately began to suspect you when you say I love you. What do you want? I had never said I love you to a human being in my life that I didn't want something from them. To stop them from being angry, to make them smile. I don't know what I wanted, but I wanted something. I have a buddy sober almost as long as I am. We've been best friends for 30-some years. And one of his favorite lines of mine is, he said, do you want to see my personality change? Watch me talk to somebody I want something from. Well, anyhow... I saw that we went to a meeting every day for her because she was weak and needed help. I saw that we read the big book every day for her, that we read the 12 and 12 every day for her, that we read the 24-hour day book every day for her. You see, I'm an injustice collector, and I was an injustice collector inside. Fuck with the little guy and I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. She needed help. And God gave me her. And in helping her, I saved me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made it. My shame was so deep, I couldn't have taken the time to do the things necessary for me to stay sober. I'd be a dead man today. You see? So what I try not to do in my life today is interpret. Eskimo story, I heard it when I was about 2 years sober and just couldn't get together with God because I didn't trust him. It's a simple story about two guys drinking in a bar in Alaska. One's an atheist, the other's a religious man. Their conversation swings around to God. The atheist looks at the religious man and says, I gave your God a chance to prove himself to me once, he didn't do it. Religious man says, well, in what manner? Atheist says, I was lost about 6 miles north of town here in a blizzard, in a terrible blizzard, and I was knelt down in the snow and screamed at the sky, God, I'm lost and I'm going to die. Religious man looks at him, smiles a knowing smile. He says, well, you must believe. You're here. Atheist said, nah, some goddamn Eskimo came along, showed me the way back to town. Well, I have come to understand that God's main instrument in my life is people. So Eskimos constantly appear in my life at the right time, never as soon as I want them to. I'm so sick of God and his 11th hour stuff, I could scream. You know? It's just... I talk to them all the time. Can't we move the solution up a couple of days? You know? Because it's these 2 days between when I really, really, really need it and you deliver it that I almost die, you know, with anxiety. So we can just put this together a little closer. I'd appreciate it a lot. You know? It always comes. I know it's coming. And, man, I'm like, So I try not to interpret today. I try, and the Eskimo's never who I want. Never who I want. I want the blonde in the corner with the great legs, you know? And it turns to be the 95-year-old woman on two aluminum crutches. That's going to be my Eskimo. It's just never do I get the Eskimo I want, you know? But I get the one I need. I get the one that has something to give me, to deliver to me. I had a terrible time in AA. I had staggering anger throughout my early first years of recovery. And by years, I mean 10, 12 years. And most of it seemed connected to my ignition key, you know? And I get in my car, and somebody would use their turn signal, and I'd be chasing them 100 miles an hour down Sunset Boulevard. Completely insane. Head hanging out the window, screaming obscenities, foam coming out of my mouth. If we were lucky, I didn't catch him. If we were unlucky, I did catch him, and I could probably be found in the middle of an intersection, standing in the middle of some guy's hood, trying to explain to him the function of the little knob on the left side of his goddamn steering wheel. And all the time I'm doing this, I got my sponsor's voice ringing in my ears saying, on any given occasion, you may be the only example of AA. So I'm homicidal and guilty at the same time. And nobody was talking about that stuff in sobriety. Everybody was fine. That was the operative word, fine. How are you? Fine. You know, the guy comes in a meeting, his wife's divorced him, he's lost his job, they rebooted his car. How are you, George? Fine, thanks. I could be going to the meeting, to a Sunday morning meeting, to be the spiritual speaker. I got so hooked on meditation because I got a third eye SRF meditation, which helped me leave my body, which is not what you want to give me to do, you know. That's like a drug for me. So I'd get up at 4 a.m. to meditate for 4 hours before I left the house. I'd be in the thunder, the silence of the lap of God, get in my car, start it, go a block, and I'd be doing 100 chasing somebody else down the street. You know? That's about how long all that meditation worked for me, right? I could be going to Sunday morning meeting to be a Sunday morning spiritual speaker, chasing some poor bastard out Ventura Boulevard at 100 miles an hour, you know? Screaming, yelling, foam coming out of my mouth, you know? Finally, I get to the meeting, you know, I wipe all the foam off, I don't want to be too obvious, get out of my car, walk in the door, the greeter's there, hey, Bob, how are you? Fine, man, how are you? Right? There's nobody else today who's talking about chasing people on the street 100 miles an hour. I'm not going to be the first because my job is to make sure you don't find out I'm not okay. Just that simple. Finally, I became so insane in sobriety, I had to talk about being insane in sobriety. And that's when I began to make a lot of friends and a lot of enemies at the same time. You know? I talked about, I'm nuts. I need help here. I need a lot of additional help here. I need a lot of stuff. Because one thing critical to me is the quality of my life. If the quality of my life is good, I'm not going to give you some nonsense about, you know, I might drink, you know, in 3 weeks. I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to drink again. I'm sober 36 goddamn years. I know how to do it. I might blow my brains out, but I won't drink again. You know? I may isolate and go away and rot to death, but I won't drink again. I mean, it's not even, I don't even think about it. It doesn't enter my mind. I haven't thought about it for 20-some years when crisis has hit and I've had monstrous ones in recovery. I don't think about drinking. Never crosses my mind. Never enters my mind. My problem is I'm a raising an insane 15-year-old adolescent because that's who I got stuck with when I got sober. The minute I smoked that first marijuana cigarette and drank that first jug of wine, I stopped being. And I get sober, and I got to raise this adolescent who's homicidal. His solution to everything is terrify everybody, even if it's just the poor girl at the dry cleaners. So I need to deal with him so I can have some quality in my life and that my whole life isn't madness, so that I can see the trees and the birds and the water and so I can see you. I can stand quietly and look in your eyes when I talk to you and be there. I get so crazy with people and they come and say, hey, how are you? Oh, man, I'm bad. You know, I'm just... And they go, oh, yeah, cool. Walk off. They didn't hear me. My best friend Tommy used to tell people in the middle of conversation, they'd be yakking at me, say, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, I killed my father last night in the parking lot. At the market. They just keep right on talking. You know, doesn't go in. Not for a minute. I did everything AA ever asked me to do, and when I was 17 years sober, the only thing I could think about was dying. Didn't want to kill myself. That wasn't a thought. There's two things I was taught in recovery, I can't do. I cannot drink or use, and I cannot kill myself. Anything else I want to do, I can do. Anything. Commit armed robbery, whatever your conscience. My sponsor said to me, whatever your conscience will let you get away with, you can do. I was stunned to find out that I was afraid of guns when I was about 14 months sober. I lived with them my entire life. I had 12-inch Remingtons. It's a good thing they never found those, or we wouldn't be having this talk either. Feds have a real short attention span, humor span on sawed-off shotguns. I didn't know who to talk to 17 years clean and sober. I didn't know where to go. All I wanted to do every morning when I woke up was not wake up. Lay down in the street somewhere and die. I thought if I could just lay down, this is the amount of shame I had. I thought if I could just lay down somewhere in the gutter and die, I'll be okay. It'll be cool. I'll be all right. It'll be over. I don't have to fight this. So I didn't know anybody in AA to talk to. I was a circuit speaker. You know, I was known around the goddamn world. I knew all these people personally. None of them had anything that they were going to help me with. I knew as much about them as they knew about me. And there was nothing in their life that indicated to me they could help me. Nothing. So where do you go? I went to a therapist. Didn't believe in therapy, didn't like therapy, had fired a couple of babies because they'd gone into therapy. Absolutely. Telling them, too, again, you know, telling them what they already knew. They came to me and said, well, I'm in therapy now, you know. So, well, obviously, AA and I aren't enough. Well, yeah, they knew that. For God's sakes, they'd gone and got a therapist. One of the things that distresses me a little bit today about Alcoholics Anonymous speakers is we got a lot of them playing MDs who aren't MDs and should keep their mouths shut unless they want to share from their personal experience. This podium is about me. It's not about my opinions about you. We have people saying, well, if you take this kind of medication, you're not sober. It's not their place to say that. It's their opinion. It's as meaningless as anything. And I have no respect for that. None. You want to stand up here and say to me that if you took a certain kind of the new medications for depression, you wouldn't consider yourself sober? Cool. I'll support you in that. But don't you dare stand there and tell me. I have 10 friends who blew their brains out over 10 years sober, and every one of them was because of depression. Don't talk to me about that crap. I'm a big supporter of the new medications, but I'm also a big cautionary about the kind of support system you should set up in AA before you begin. And they aren't just because you feel bad because your relationship went in the toilet. They're about if you can't get out of the house. If you like, I used to be where I wake up every morning and weep for 4 or 5 hours and couldn't get out of bed. Sober, going to meetings, working steps, carrying panels in the institution. Couldn't leave my house. Couldn't leave my house. I've always been manic. You get a lot of crap about therapy. Our whole life is supposed to be in the first 164 pages of the big book. I wish the people that promote that would read the first 164 pages of the big book. This is it, right? Haven't you heard that? That's it. Oh, you know, this is that bootstrap, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, son. Hey, for the strong. We throw people away with the phrase, they stop going to meetings. We throw human beings away. This is like a cancer institute for people who have cancer. Most cancer patients I know or have ever heard of show up. So if somebody doesn't show up here, of course you should not be just dismiss them. It should be why did they stop? You see somebody stop coming to meetings in your group, call them up. Maybe we'll have enough here for them. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with AA. AA is wonderful. I love AA. AA is the foundation on which I built my own life. If you think I didn't love this program, you think I'd talk about this stuff that just makes people go home and stay awake for hours? It's just my opinion, and you ought to know I can change it on the way home, you know? I can be driving home from a talk and say, God, I don't know if I believe that or not, you know? You're up till 6 in the morning. You're not ready to kill me for being some heretic in AA. And I'm agreeing with you. I just haven't had a chance to say it yet. Now about health. A body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. Written in 1935, depression. We are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is the most powerful health restorative. Amen. We who have recovered from serious drinking are miracles of mental health. But we have seen remarkable transformations in our bodies. Hardly one of our crowd now shows any mark of dissipation. Now this part's really unclear. This is very unclear. This is really murky stuff. But this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly, hear this? This is what our old timers are saying to us, the ones in the very beginning, not our new old timers. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. Most of them give freely of themselves that their fellows may enjoy sound minds and bodies. Try to remember that though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. Their services are often indispensable in treating a newcomer and in following his case afterwards. This is our founders. Now, I don't even want to guess at what Bill meant by various practitioners. Okay, I don't want to touch that. And we remember that he and Arthur Ford, the psychic, were good friends before Arthur got sober. Remember that Bill and Dr. Bob used to do the Ouija board after every meeting. There's a sense that maybe, you know, he might have meant something that most people didn't get. This is 134, still in the first sacred 164 pages of the Big Book. A word about sex relations. Alcohol is so sexually stimulating, I don't know who the hell wrote that, but anyway. Was not my experience. You give me 10 and a half cc's of methamphetamine and a fifth of Gin Beam and I'm okay, but if you forget the methamphetamine, it's going to be a dull night, let me tell you. Alcohol is so sexually stimulating to some men that they have overindulged. Couples are occasionally dismayed to find that when drinking is stopped, the man tends to be impotent. Unless the reason is understood, there may be an emotional upset. Some of us have had this experience only to enjoy in a few months a finer intimacy than ever. There should be no hesitancy in consulting a doctor or psychologist if the condition persists. This is our Big Book saying, look, you need a... I agree. That's exactly my sentiment. That's out of here, guys. That's out of the first 164 pages. I'm not telling you what to do. I just know that I need additional help, and I'm thrilled to death that my Big Book says, go get it, kid. Have a good time. Find the people you need to help keep you sober. That's what it says to me. Yeah? I found out, hanging in there with this therapist, that I was allowed to meet the man that I am as opposed to the man I've always believed myself to be. And that was a major turning point in my recovery. A major turning point. There's a lot of talk about people who try and do childhood work here. You know, come on, that's a long time ago. You know, oh, God. I tell you, I'm really peaceful about this stuff now. It used to just make me nuts. My sponsors told me the most important step I was ever going to face because of where I came from and what I did was the amends step. They said that was the step that separated men from the boys. I had to go see people crippled for the rest of their life because of actions that took place when we were all dealing drugs. None of my amends went well. Most of them told me they were sorry I was alive, much less in a program of recovery. My sponsors told me if I didn't do this step, if I did not deal as quickly as possible with the consequences of my actions, I would die. That's what they told me. Okay. Well, 17 years sober, I had to turn around and begin to deal with the consequences of the actions of others on me. You see? My life sober was being controlled by being a battered child. I've been married 6 times in sobriety. I'm willing. Obviously, I'm willing. You know, I just... Yeah. That's an expensive hobby, let me tell you. No one can shop on a credit card like an emotionally distressed woman, particularly if it's on the card of the person she's distressed at. Whoa. Does that sound unusual to any of you that have figured it out? I'm a battered child by a woman. I was beaten senseless. I had my bones broken by a woman. I'm great with covertly angry women. If all your anger is underneath, I love you and you love me because we hate each other and we'll all come out sexually and we'll call it love, you know. That's how we'll explain all the broken furniture and plaster and rug burns and everything else. I love you, you know. Sorry about the hood of the car.
Careful, Bob. You're getting lost here.
See, I, my days are like this. Can you imagine living with me all day? I mean, my whole day is like this. I get up in the morning and it starts, you know. Well, what can we do today? Who can we crucify today? Who can we think bad of today? Well, you know, I got to just reach for the Bible, you know, or I'm gone. My mornings now, spiritually, are a can of Diet Coke, a cigar, and the Bible. Why are you reading the Bible, Bob? Well, I've talked about it for years, and I never read it. I thought it was probably time I should read it. That's not an unusual thing in AA for people to talk about things they don't know anything about. Hell, who we are, you know. We did it in bars. Why should it change here? I mean, we've got, you know, we've got doctors and surgeons and airline pilots and all these people. That's what we do when we drink. You think it stops because we're here? Nah, not in your life. I had to learn to go back and deal. The point I was trying to make was if a woman gets angry at me, overtly angry at me, just yelling and screaming at me, I am immediately emotionally reduced to a 2-year-old child who is going to get badly hurt and no one is going to come help him. That's why my relationships didn't last before. I was afraid. When I get afraid, I shut down. When I shut down, I freeze you out. When I freeze you out, eventually you've got one or two choices. Kill yourself or go away. Fortunately, all the women I married had sponsors who convinced them that I wasn't worth killing themselves over. I didn't like it at the time. Now I'm most grateful for it. So all I'm trying to say is, standing here, you know, I'm a father of a 10-year-old daughter today, by the way, who I just had for 3 weeks, and I can't even get into what an incredible gift this child has been to my life in learning how to be a good parent. The child's never been struck. 10 years old, she's never been hit. If somebody hit her, she would go into shock. Absolute shock. Now that's not natural for me. My immediate instinct is to just bust her one. I have to count 10 all the time with her, because why would I hit someone that I love so much? I used to sit in a rocking chair by her crib at night and weep with joy because she was in my life. Because that's what was done to me. That's all I know. I know it works. If I punch her, she'll either start doing what I want her to do or stop doing what I don't want her to do. But I never had to do that. So I live with this little power. I mean, a 10-year-old with all her power is like having 3 other adults in the house, you know. It's incredible. I remember the first time I was telling him before me, I read this book on choices. You know, I'm trying to be a parent. We're reading Penelope Leach's Birth to Age, every goddamn book we can get our hands on. Because Tina was raised by 2 alcoholic parents, and I was raised by, you know, a battering mother and alcoholic parent. And we figured we better start reading now, because we don't know nothing about how to raise a child right. And I'm reading this book on choices, and I remember saying to Alexander one day, well, this is your choice, and this is your choice. I'm really proud of myself. I think, what a great concept this is. Let her pick. Give her choices. She looks at me and says, I don't like either one of them, Dad. I go, well, why in the hell didn't they put that in the book? You know? What do you do now? Anyway, we worked it out. I need a lot of things to help me in my recovery. I need to read and get more information. Information is what saves my life if I will read it and apply it. You know, this is. I'll leave you on a note that really makes some people just cringe. This is our Bible, our big book, our text, our sacred book, and I agree with all of that. This is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also 60 years old. If I'm going for surgery tomorrow morning, I hope to God the doctor who's going to operate on me has read something more current on the procedure than something 60 years old. Now, it doesn't mean I don't want him to have read the basic text, because if he ain't got that, he can't do it anyway. But I want them to have the most recent information about what's available. And although some people don't like to talk about it, and people don't like to hear about it, depression is a major problem in the recovering alcoholic. I would say depression has probably killed more alcoholics and taken more alcoholics out of meetings than anything else. And it's got nothing to do with you being a bad person. Something you've got no control over. I'd like to see us become more inclusive here. You know, I like to belong to an organization that includes people, not to dismisses people and throws them away. I mean, that's what our founders wanted. This is a brotherhood here, a sisterhood here. We're supposed to support each other. I spent our whole time criticizing each other. We've got a rumor mill in AA that's probably more bigger than IBM's. You know? And you know why it works? Because you and I allow it. Somebody comes to you saying, "Oh, Clancy got drunk." You know what your first line should be? "Did you see him? If you didn't see him, don't talk to me. Mary and Fred are sleeping together. Did you see him?" No, I'm serious. I'm serious. Because there's a part of me that loves for the other guy to get it. You know? So you come to me with information saying, "Fred lost his $2 million job." I'm like, "Oh, poor Fred. Jesus, God, that's terrible." You know? I'm really sorry. I went to a channeler one time who channeled this spirit. I can't even remember his name now. Paid him lots of money. You know, whether it is or whether it isn't, you can draw your own conclusions. But I said to the spirit, I said, "Okay, look, you know, I'm dying out here. What's enlightenment mean? I feel like I need it. I feel like I'm heavy all the time. Like I got extra stuff." He said, "It means lighten up." So I'd like to leave you with that about a lot of this stuff. We're getting too serious here. I think we need to lighten up a little bit. Have some fun. Get sober. Go out and play a little bit. And not worry so much about what the other person is doing. Thank you. God bless you. Good night.